Thanks for joining us. I'm Susan Page of USA Today, sitting in for Diane Rehm. Diane is recuperating at home from a cracked pelvis. She hopes to be back on the air next week. The U.S. and NATO commander in Afghanistan, General Stanley McChrystal, calls the situation there serious, but he says the war can still be won if there is a shift in strategy. That shift would include stronger efforts to protect civilians and to take back areas controlled by the Taliban. Joining me in the studio to discuss where the United States is headed in Afghanistan, Nathan Fryer of the Center for Strategic and International Studies. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
And by phone from New York, Max Boot of the Council on Foreign Relations. Welcome to the Diane Rehm Show.
Thanks very much.
And we're going to be joined by phone from Kandahar by Rajiv Chandrasekharan of the Washington Post. We're trying to make a connection with him now, and we'll bring him on the air as soon as we have him. Well, Max Boot, let's start with you. This report that was submitted yesterday by General McChrystal, the 60-day strategic review, we've been waiting for it. It's hotly awaited for this document to come forward. How significant do you think the strategic shift is that he proposes in that?
I think it's very significant. I mean, I should preface that by saying that the report has not been released. So what we're going on is some leaks and some general impressions of what General McChrystal is saying. But basically, from my understanding, is he wants to shift from a minimal type of strategy that we've been pursuing in Afghanistan really since 2001 to a more intensive counterinsurgency strategy of the kind that has proven more successful in Iraq and in numerous other conflicts around the world over the years, which will require, I think it is generally assumed, more troops to establish control in villages and cities, drive out the Taliban, and allow the Afghan government to function in the way that it's meant to function. That's something we really have not been doing. We have not been resourcing this war. We have not been applying these classic counterinsurgency strategies. And General McChrystal is there to do that and to turn around what has been a very troubled war effort.
And so are you convinced that this is the right direction for the United States to take?
Absolutely. I don't think we have any alternative, because if we don't do this, we're going to allow essentially a replay of the 1990s with the Taliban slowly taking back control of Afghanistan and turning it into a terrorist haven. We will see a rapidly declining situation across the border in Pakistan. It will be a disaster. It will be a huge, huge mess from our vantage point. It will be a huge victory for some of the most dangerous enemies that we have in the world. And so we have to make this commitment right now. And it is a very winnable war if we just increase our resources and apply the right strategy to it.
Nathan Fryer, we've just heard Max Boot say this is a winnable war. What it needs is more resources. What do you think about that?
Well, my sense actually has been for some time that first we have to define what winnable means. The definition of success has always been quite limited in Afghanistan, rhetorically, but we've actually pursued over really the course of the last 5 years much more expansive ways, and I think Afghanistan is a classic example of mission creep. I would suggest that instead of actually pouring more resources into the problem, we need to become more focused in what we're trying to do, taking a much more minimalist approach. I would disagree slightly with Max in that we've taken a minimalist viewpoint of Afghanistan. I think we've actually under-resourced a maximalist strategy, where what I think we need to do is properly resource a much more limited strategy.
You know, I think a lot of Americans would look at Afghanistan and not be sure what winning would mean. For you, Nathan Fryer, what would winning in Afghanistan mean?
In my sense, you know, the way you look at Afghanistan now really dates back to the way you looked at it in 2001. I mean, the intervention in 2001 was either a punitive and disruptive intervention on the part of the United States, or it was transformative. If you thought of it as a punitive and disruptive intervention, then you were really looking to manage your terrorist problem that you saw to be a problem for some time to come. If you saw it as transformative, you thought that transformation of Afghan society would fundamentally impact the terrorist problem over time. I think that we've had mixed messages over the last several years in that regard.
And for you, would it be the first or the second?
It would be the first.
The first, which was punitive and disruptive, which we've succeeded.
Yes.
How about you, Max Boot? If you were going to define winning in Afghanistan, what would you say that would be?
Well, it's not that hard. I think if we could just get the situation back to where it was in 2002, 2003, where the Taliban were on the run, they didn't control any substantial portion of Afghan soil in Afghanistan was not a staging ground for extremists, that would be tremendous. But that's not where we are. And unfortunately, if we want to disrupt the Taliban, we have to create governance at the grassroots level in Afghanistan. We have to create a basic level of security, because right now the Taliban are not being disrupted. We're not. They're resurgent. The allies of al-Qaeda are on the offensive, and if we downsize our efforts, they will go even further and gain control of even more territory. So we cannot meet even a minimal objective unless we make a concerted effort.
And how many more troops, Max Boot, do you think, are how many more U.S. troops are needed in Afghanistan to do the kind of job you're outlining?
Well, it's very hard to say out of the blue, and that's the issue that General McChrystal is studying right now. But, you know, if you look at ballpark figures, a rule of thumb is that you need something like one counterinsurgent per 50 population. And the area you're talking about in Afghanistan is basically the Pashtun belt, where the Pashtuns are concentrated, in an area of about 16 million people. So you're probably talking a total of maybe 320,000 or so counterinsurgents, of whom a lot of whom are going to be Afghans. One of the things we have to do is to grow the number of Afghans, so that we have Afghan security forces of maybe 240,000 or so within a year or two. But on top of that, you're probably going to need at least 100,000 American troops, and right now we're only going to have about 68,000. So I think there's still going to be a gap there of maybe 20 or 30,000 troops that we're going to have to commit in order to get Afghanistan through this difficult period and get to the point where the Afghan security forces can take over the bulk of the fight in the way that the Iraqi security forces are already taking over the bulk of the fight.
We're opening our phones. You can give us a call at 1-800-433-8850 or send us an email at drshow@wamu.org. And we're joined now by Rajiv Chandrasekharan, who joins us. He's an assistant managing editor for Continuous News at the Washington Post. That's a great title. And he joins us from Afghanistan. Where are you in Afghanistan, Rajiv?
Hey, good morning, Susan. I'm actually at the massive, sprawling Kandahar Air Base, which is literally growing by the minute as additional U.S. forces pour into southern Afghanistan here. You got sort of bulldozers and cranes building housing and command centers and whatnot. And if you hear noise behind me as I talk, it's because there are a bunch of fighter jets that are taking off here this evening.
Well, it's a miracle of modern communications that we can talk with you on your cell phone from Afghanistan, so we're glad that's worked out. Tell us about the latest on the allegations of fraud in the presidential election that took place about 2 weeks ago. What's happening with that?
Well, you know, there continue to be counting efforts going on in Kabul. Obviously, this is of great concern to American and other foreign officials in this country, who really had hoped for a more fair and transparent and credible election than seems to have occurred. Every day also brings some new allegations of malfeasance raised by challengers to Hamid Karzai, most notably Abdullah, the principal rival. And everybody is just sort of in wait-and-see mode here, waiting for final results and what those may portend.
Nathan Fryer, how big a complication is it for the United States that we had this election? It hasn't been settled. There are all these allegations of stuffing ballot boxes and voter intimidation. What does that do for the in terms of the United States approach to Afghanistan?
I think it's an enormous problem. I think predominantly because at the very point that we may be recommending a substantial increase in our commitment and investment in Afghanistan, we are faced with the potential of a fatally undermined political authority at the center of our effort. And so I think it's a huge problem.
Max Boot, do you agree?
Well, it is a problem, but, you know, we shouldn't have exaggerated expectations for Afghanistan, given our own long history of voter fraud and ballot stuffing, which was, you know, the dominant way elections in America were conducted until the last few decades and is still, you know, pretty prevalent in some states. We shouldn't expect that Afghanistan is going to be this pristine temple of democracy. I think certainly these allegations are not good, but, you know, Afghanistan is able to hold elections. It is able to have a potentially to have a transfer of power if Hamid Karzai were to lose. So I think it's actually making pretty decent progress considering the huge challenges that it faces.
Nathan Pryor.
Yeah, I would actually, I'd have to agree with Max on a couple of points. I mean, I think it's very important that Afghanistan has now really conducted what I think are two presidential elections. And therefore are actually moving along in some direction toward some form of representative government. I think that, that with that will come some increased independence or desire for independence on the part of the Afghan government, and therefore I don't think we need to be actually substantially underwriting dependency on the part of the Afghans either.
Rajiv, we're about to take a short break, but I want to ask you just very quickly, what is the mood of the U.S. forces that you've talked to in Afghanistan?
Well, you know, their spirits are reasonably high. Most of the new forces here in southern Afghanistan, where I am, have only recently arrived here, and so you know they know they have a long fight ahead of them. They remain concerned that there are not enough Afghan security forces for them to partner with, and they remain very concerned that Afghan government services here and government officials just are very ineffective. It's worth noting, just on your previous question about the impact of the election season, that down here at the local level, as I talk to people in villages and towns across this part of the country, their concern is more corruption at a local level. Yes, they don't like the idea that an election may be decided by fraudulent means, but what they care about most is corruption at the local level, police officers who steal from them, local government officials who are on the take.
All right.
And that's really the big challenge.
We're going to take a very short break. Stay with us. Welcome back. I'm Susan Page of USA Today, sitting in for Diane Rehm. And we're joined from Afghanistan, Rajiv Chandrasekharan. He's with The Washington Post. And from New York by Max Boot. He's a senior fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations and author of a book called War Made New. And here with me in the studio, Nathan Pryor. He's a senior fellow at the International Security Program at CSIS and a visiting professor at the U.S. Army War College. Well, one of the fundamental things that General McChrystal talks about in the strategic review that was submitted yesterday was the need to protect the citizens, the civilians in Afghanistan, really a lesson learned by the U.S. in Iraq. How do things stand now, Nathan Pryor, in terms of the security that the average person in Afghanistan feels?
I think especially as Max pointed out, in southern Afghanistan, folks are relatively insecure. But I think that actually properly resourcing over time a more minimal risk management strategy that may include a modest increase in U.S. forces to really jumpstart the Afghan security forces in that region in particular may go some way to help. But I think that commitment needs to be under decreasing terms.
Max Boot, how does it look to you?
Well, I agree that there is pervasive insecurity right now in southern Afghanistan and to some extent in eastern Afghanistan, which has to be addressed. General McChrystal is absolutely right that creating security for the people is the fundamental precept of successful counterinsurgency, and the Afghan security forces are too small to provide that security right now on their own, and so they need more assistance. We're providing some more of that assistance by surging our own troops, but I think we need to do even more in order to drive back the Taliban after they've had several years of gains.
Rajiv, how does it look to you there? What's your sense of how secure people feel?
People don't feel very secure at all. And the challenge is twofold. They feel insecure because obviously the Taliban moves with a degree of impunity down in this area. But they also feel insecure because in some cases, perhaps in many cases in parts of the South, the officials who are supposed to provide security, their local police forces, are fundamentally corrupt and they're stealing from the people. And so the big challenge here is as General McChrystal and the forces under his command move forward with a population-centric counterinsurgency strategy. The goal isn't just to create more Afghan security forces that can take over, but to ensure that those security forces are actually acting in the interests of the people, and thus you win over the allegiances of the people. Right now, people are acquiescing to the Taliban in part because of Taliban intimidation, but also in part because they look and they see their police as not just not helping them, but actively contributing to the problem. I was talking to a man in Kandahar City just 2 days ago who was noting that while the Taliban set up checkpoints in the city at night, they never take money from the people, he says to me, whereas the police officers who were just patrolling by his market stall a few hours earlier stole half the watermelons.
That sounds like a big job, though, for the U.S. to clean up the police forces of Afghanistan. It's realistically, Nathan Fryer, is that something the U.S. is going to be able to do?
Well, I think if that was our only task, maybe it would be within the realm of the possible. But I think actually what we're trying to do and what seems to be suggested by sort of the conventional wisdom right now is that we're going to attempt to fight a very intense counterinsurgency, clean up corruption at both the national, intermediate, and local levels, fight opium production and narcotics trafficking, and also stop the flow of, the bad forces going back and forth between Pakistan and Afghanistan. I think that's a tall order for the United States, actually, to accomplish in a very short period of time.
Max Boot, do you think this is achievable?
I think it's absolutely achievable, especially when you look at the fact that only 4% of the Afghan people in public opinion polls say they want the Taliban back. There is no popular support for a return to Taliban rule. The only way they're able to make gains is because there is a governance and security vacuum in much of the countryside, and they're able to fill it. And we need to help the government of Afghanistan to fill that vacuum itself, and I think we can do that because fundamentally the people are against the Taliban, and they don't want what the Taliban is offering. They've tried that before. They've rejected it. They really want help from their own government principally, but also from its international supporters to drive back the Taliban who are terrorizing them and making impossible the democratic progress they want to see.
Well, Max, but you mentioned public opinion polling in Afghanistan. Let's talk for a moment about public opinion polling here in the United States. There was an ABC News Washington Post poll that came out about 2 weeks ago that said that more than half of Americans now say the Afghanistan war is not worth fighting. And I wonder to what degree this is an issue for the Obama administration and to what degree it limits President Obama's options as he looks to how what strategy to pursue moving forward.
Well, it is an issue, but it's only really an issue if President Obama lets it be an issue. I mean, remember that a far higher percentage of the public had turned against the war in Iraq in 2006. And nevertheless, President Bush decided to surge forces, which was incredibly unpopular. If you recall back to 2007, everybody was against the surge until it started working. And then when it started working, public opinion turned around and became much more supportive of the war effort. I think we can see something similar happen in Afghanistan. I mean, the reason why people are against the war right now is because they don't see progress. It's not because they think it's not worth fighting or that we have no stake. They just don't see that we're making progress. And I think if we can make progress, all of a sudden you will see public opinion will be much more supportive. But in order to make that kind of progress, President Obama has to do something which is going to be in the short term unpopular, which is to provide more resources for our troops to win the battle.
You know, one thing that's different, though, about the situation that President Obama faces now is that his base, liberal Democrats, tend to be opposed to the war. It's Republicans who are most supportive of the effort in Afghanistan. For President Bush, that was reversed. You know, his Republican base was most likely to be supportive of the war in Iraq. And I wonder, Nathan Fryer, do you think what are the stakes for Obama, for President Obama, as he looks to what to do in Afghanistan while public opinion is fading?
Well, I think fundamentally the question regarding Afghanistan is how important is Afghanistan overall, and how important is a modestly functioning Afghanistan to the core security interests of the United States? And I think actually if you do an evaluation of that and take a much more modest approach in Afghanistan and really refocus your effort, albeit indirectly, on Pakistan, you're going to be much better off in the interest to cost calculation.
Let's go to the phones. We've got a lot of people waiting to get on the air. We'll go first to Bill, who's calling us from Slidell, California. Bill, hi, you're on the air.
Thank you. That's Slidell, Louisiana.
All right. Thanks very much for the correction.
My question is this. In 1969, I was drafted, a slightly fudgy college kid, and 8 months later, I was an airborne qualified jungle fighter ready to go to Vietnam. And my question is, what do we expect with Afghan if we can't train these guys up over the 6-plus years we've been working with them? Why don't we get better results from that?
All right, let me ask our panel, who'd like to respond to Bill's question? Nathan.
Well, I'd be...
No, Max Boot, go ahead.
But I'd be happy to take a shot at it, which is that we're not getting bad results. Actually, the Afghan National Army is doing a pretty good job by all accounts. The police, as has been noted, are extremely corrupt, largely because they're not getting paid. They get no salary, so the only way they can support themselves is through bribes. But the Afghan Army is doing a pretty decent job, but the problem is they're way too small. I mean, the Afghan Army is about 80,000 personnel right now for a country of 30 million. I mean, keep in mind that in Iraq, the security forces there are over 500,000. So it's not that the Afghans aren't willing to fight or that the security forces are hopeless. It's that they haven't gotten the resources they need, principally from the international community, in order to expand to meet the growing threat that they face.
Nathan, we have several callers who are making a comparison between Afghanistan and the war in Vietnam. Do you think that's a fair one? Do you see parallels, or does that not make sense to you?
No, I don't see real parallels. I mean, there may be some political comparisons that one can make about how elected officials make decisions or how they avoid decisions, but I think that the parallel is not accurate. I would like to add to Max's point. I think he's right in the fact that probably there aren't enough Afghan security forces, and there need to be more. And he's also right in this idea that the army is performing better than the police are performing, and that's actually similar or akin to the experience we actually had in Iraq, where you did actually have much more success earlier on with the Iraqi army, the national army, than you did, of course, with the Ministry of Interior Forces. I would actually say, though, the one point I have to actually make is it's very difficult to build an army and internal security forces without the unifying sort of principle of a central government worth defending. And right now, I think that's a fundamental problem in Afghanistan.
Rajiv, Max Boot made a comment about whether President Obama will do what President Bush did in Iraq, which was increase U.S. force levels, even in the face of negative public opinion here at home. And I wonder, do the U.S. military officials you talked to there see a difference between dealing with President Bush on these war issues and dealing with President Obama?
Well, one thing to note right up front is that President Obama does not engage in the same sort of regular video teleconferencing with the commander of the war here, General McChrystal, as President Bush did with General Petraeus when he was commanding the forces in Iraq. There's a more distant relationship that is perceived by commanders here, and they're heartened by President Obama's initial decisions to deploy the additional forces here thus far this year. And it remains an open question among them whether they feel like they'll get the necessary support they need from Washington. You know, when I talk to commanders about is this war winnable, and how long will it take? There's a near uniformity of opinion that they feel like the strategy that they are implementing now is a strategy that they think is workable. They finally have sort of settled upon something that they think makes sense if it's properly resourced. But the one thing almost everybody cautions me about is that they're not going to necessarily see the sort of progress on the timeline that Washington wants. You know, Washington wants this war turned around with some really positive metrics in 12 to 18 months. And folks on the ground here question, they think it will turn around, but they question just how much they can really show right away. They caution that this is an undertaking that really will take some significant degree of time, because you have to build up the capacity of those Afghan forces, you have to establish governance, and you have to build security. And just on the Vietnam question, one point worth noting is that there is no sort of groundswell of support, as Max Boot rightly noted, among the Afghan people for the Taliban. Unlike in South Vietnam, there's no sort of romanticized notion of what a communist, you know, Vietnam would be. People here in Afghanistan have lived under the Taliban. They know how brutal that regime was. And so they're not willingly choosing to want to go back. That's not the future that they really want.
I'm Susan Page, and you're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. We're taking your calls and reading your emails, drshow@wamu.org. Let's talk to Eddie. He's calling us from New York City. Eddie, thanks for joining us on The Diane Rehm Show.
Thank you. Hi, how are you guys doing today?
Good.
My question has to do with the opium issue. I feel that the United States is more of an advocate of the opium production, even though, you know, politically they don't take that stance. But, I mean, the hospitals in this country, they all have opium products, and it's one of the main sources of opium for the world. And I feel that the troops really safeguard our interests to these crops, and that really the government doesn't want to see our troops leave this country anytime soon because of this interest.
All right. Well, Eddie, thanks for your call. Nathan Fryer, you're shaking your head no.
No, I think there's a legitimate industry that produces opiates for use in medical under medical circumstances, and clearly Afghanistan is not one of those sources.
Max Boot, what do you think? Why do you think General McChrystal chose not to specify whether he was going to ask for more troops, and if so, how many in this report? Because there had been reporting for weeks and weeks about speculation about what level of additional troop levels he would ask to have. Why didn't he?
Well, it's very simple. He was told by Secretary of Defense Bob Gates not to do that, not to include a troop request in his initial assessment, and so he complied with that request. But I think it's generally been reported that very shortly, probably in the next few weeks, he will come up with a list of the kind of resources he needs to carry out the strategy which he has outlined in this classified strategic assessment, which was delivered yesterday.
Why did Defense Secretary Gates tell him not to include a number?
That's a very good question. I think a lot of it has to do with the fact that there is significant resistance within the administration or elements of the administration to sending more troops to Afghanistan. General Jones, the National Security Advisor, suggested that this would be a whiskey tango foxtrot moment for the administration if they were to hear a large troop request coming on top of the one.
Tell me what that means.
Well, I'm not going to spell it out on the air, but whiskey tango foxtrot is WTF, and you can imagine what that is an acronym for. General Jones suggested basically that there would be raised eyebrows, to put it mildly, in the administration if the commanders came back and asked for more beyond the 21,000 troops that were approved earlier this year. But I think what General McChrystal is finding is he's going to need more because he can't implement the strategy he wants to implement with the forces that he has. And I imagine that as a result of that, he will ask for those troops, and we will see what the administration response is going to be.
Nathan Fryer.
Yeah, I think I understand to a certain degree the reluctance toward an increase in troop strength, but also on the point of why the two surveys came in at a different time. I think that one basically was to describe the problem, and the second was to basically describe the cost necessary to address the problem, which I think is sort of a natural progression of things. I would argue that from a grand strategic perspective, there is a risk calculation that goes on here. I mean, if you look at risk as the likelihood of failure, prohibitive costs in achieving one or more of your strategic objectives, I think that we're definitely from a higher level calculation, we're definitely in the area of achieving either one or both of those, either getting accruing prohibitive costs in this effort or actually setting strategic objectives that are unachievable.
Rajiv, is this a sign of the sensitivity of this whole issue, the fact that no numbers for troops in the report, and the report is classified, even members of Congress haven't been given copies of it?
Well, you know, this is an incredibly volatile issue, and I think Secretary Gates and Chairman Mullen and General Petraeus, General McChrystal's immediate superior, don't want this assessment to be essentially overwhelmed by a debate over a number. They want first the sober assessment to sink in, and that to be subject to discussion. And there may well be an unclassified version of this that will be subsequently released to members of Congress and the media. And then they hope once that sinks in, they can have a further discussion about what's actually necessary to make it happen.
I know Rajiv has to go back to work in Afghanistan. Thanks so much for being with us. We're going to take a short break and then we'll come back, continue taking your calls and questions. Stay with us.
National broadcast of the Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by the German Embassy, presenting Germany Info, a web publication with daily news from Germany, business and investment information, and suggestions for travel to Europe, on the web at germany.info. From Kaufman, the foundation of entrepreneurship, committed to growing economies and expanding human welfare, on the web at kaufman.org. And by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, helping NPR advance journalistic excellence in the digital age. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
A community leader and socialite commits suicide after a bitter divorce in 1963. Her daughter is now a psychiatrist, wife, and mother. The search to understand why her mother took her own life. A story of loss, reconciliation, and healing. The Diane Rehm Show, next hour. Welcome back. I'm Susan Page of USA Today, sitting in for Diane Rehm. And with me in the studio, Nathan Fryer from the Center for Strategic and International Studies. He's a visiting professor at the U.S. Army War College. And joining us by phone from New York, Max Boot, senior fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations. We're talking about the proposed change in strategy in Afghanistan and what may be ahead. We've got on the phone Masoud Aziz. He is a former senior advisor at the Embassy of Afghanistan here in Washington. He is now an independent analyst. Thanks for giving us a call.
Hi, Suzanne.
I wanted to ask you what your sense is on what Afghan citizens hope the U.S. does going forward.
Well, of course, Afghans always wanted to have basic security, safety, shelter, food, and a sense of hope for the future. And one of the things that concern me now is this discussion about additional resources or limiting our engagement in Afghanistan, are in fact some even calling for disengagement. And the story is really that a policy of disengagement in the past is what got us to where we are today. And in fact, that intervention from the U.S. perspective does not have to be costly and unending. And instead, it really has to focus and have a long-term view and be more fully committed. There's a great example of a program that has been extremely successful in Afghanistan in the early years after the ousting of the Taliban that was not costly and achieved many of the goals that we are now talking about, meaning protecting the population, developing the rural areas. It was called the National Solidarity Program. That program was established around 2003. It sought to empower at the grassroots level Afghans in the rural areas by helping them establish local governance bodies, you know, so-called community development councils. And then simple block grants in cash were provided to them, about $200 per family. And these cash grants were directly given to these elected bodies at the local levels to help them carry out rural, small-scale projects that communities chose themselves. It touched 20,000 communities, the entire country, across all 34 provinces, two-thirds of the rural population. And many Afghans at that time in the rural areas said that they had never felt more connected to their governments than before. And the entire program costed about $500 million in the initial years. This is how you protect the population, the local population, not through military operations alone, and not by spending billions of dollars too late or in the wrong strategies.
All right. Masoud Aziz, thank you so much for giving us a call.
Sure.
Now, Nathan Farr, you were nodding your head during this. You're familiar with the program that he was talking about.
Well, not in specific, but I actually philosophically am very much in line with Mr. Aziz. I do think that we – hearkening back to my Iraq experience, we probably spent too much time focusing at the national level and not enough nearly at sort of empowering local communities. And I think Mr. Aziz's idea of empowering local communities through some direct engagement is very important. And I also want to be very clear, I'm not suggesting complete disengagement from Afghanistan either. I'm simply talking about sort of having more modesty in what we feel we can achieve.
Max, but we do know that General McChrystal is talking for more development aid as well as military aid. Is that the direction you think the United States should go?
Well, there's no question that we need some more developmental assistance, so we need some more civilian aid. We need a greater surge of civilians, I think, not so much to develop Afghanistan into this flourishing economy, but simply to give it a baseline level of government that functions, which will require, embedding U.S. advisors with governors and district chiefs much further down the line and not just concentrating on the major industries in Kabul, as we've done too often in the past. That has to be part of a comprehensive counterinsurgency strategy.
Now, Max, but we have a question for you from an emailer, Bill in Little Rock. He says, a question for Mr. Boot. Why do we have to conquer the Taliban? They had no foreign policy before we invaded their country and began shooting at them. Obnoxious as they are, let's leave them alone and chase al-Qaeda. How would you respond to Bill?
Well, that's essentially the strategy that we followed before 9/11, which was to leave the Taliban alone and chase al-Qaeda. And we see how well that worked, because unfortunately the Taliban are joined at the hip with al-Qaeda, and they provide sanctuary for al-Qaeda, and al-Qaeda provides financial and other support for the Taliban. What happened after 9/11, of course, was that we chased them out of Afghanistan, so they took up residence in the Pakistan frontier regions, but now they're starting to move back into Afghanistan. But our presence in Afghanistan provides the best means that we have of hitting al-Qaeda and the really noxious terrorist groups, which are located in Pakistan, because we're able to fly drones, we're able to do other cross-border types of operations, which we would not be able to do if we weren't in Afghanistan with a fairly substantial presence.
Is that how it looks to you, Nathan Farr?
Well, I would actually say that the focused approach that Max suggests right there is not the approach we're taking right now. I mean, the approach we're taking right now is we're basically fighting the Taliban in Afghanistan is a proxy for what little we can do actually in Pakistan against the Taliban in Pakistan. And And I do believe that our continued presence on some level in Afghanistan, continued surveillance, the use of precision violence and pressure by proxy against both the Taliban and any resurgent terrorist sanctuaries are going to be exceedingly important. But the question is how big and how much and how long.
And of course, every U.S. analyst I've talked to says Pakistan is the most dangerous place on earth for the United States and the most critical place. Max Boot, talk about how the war in Afghanistan is affecting what's going on in Pakistan in terms of our interests there.
Well, the fact that we're in Afghanistan along the border regions gives us our best vantage point from which to attack Al-Qaeda and related groups which have strongholds in Pakistan. If we were to downsize our commitment in Afghanistan, we would lose a lot of the pressure points that we currently have against those terrorists. And, you know, part of the reason why the government of Pakistan is providing any degree of cooperation to us, which, you know, is not an optimal level of cooperation, but some cooperation, is because they see us making some kind of long-term commitment to the region. But if we were suddenly to start to pull out or draw down our force levels in Afghanistan, that would be read as America's on the way out, and the government in Islamabad, as well as the one in Kabul, would have to start making greater accommodations with the extremists and the radicals, and that would be extremely dangerous. That's something we want to avoid. Whereas if we can impose some degree of security and stability in Afghanistan, there's a chance that we can actually export some of that stability across the frontier region, because the same tribes straddle both sides of the Durand Line, the frontier between Pakistan and Afghanistan.
Nathan Ferrer, do you agree that the war in Afghanistan is helping U.S. interests in Pakistan?
I think that, no, actually, I wouldn't say yes or no. What I would say right now is that really what we need to do, and I think Max and I are more in agreement on this point than anything else. I mean, I think that what we need to do is refocus our effort in South Asia more broadly to actually continue to put some pressure on the Taliban, albeit again under some decreasing terms through the Afghan government, but at the same time continue enough presence in Afghanistan to maintain pressure and to do exactly as Max points out, sort of maintain the ability to strike at Al-Qaeda inside Pakistan.
Let's go to another caller. Sawosu is calling us from Dallas, Texas. Hi, you're on the air.
Yes, thank you for taking my call. Yeah, my question is, will it not be a good idea to go back to the NATO members and ask them for help, either natural resources or human resources, to contribute by convincing them that winning this war in Afghanistan is also part of their own benefit? Because it appears like the Europeans are more relaxed and leaving the whole problem to Americans.
You know, I think the administration would very much like more help from NATO and other countries. How possible is it, or probable is it, that they'll get more help?
I think probably one of the when looking back at the war in Afghanistan, one of the potentially great mistakes was actually not taking NATO's invocation of Article 5 more seriously at the beginning of the Afghan intervention, and actually turning it into a NATO war much earlier. I think we're actually faced now with sort of a darker alternative, and that's NATO actually losing interest, or at least losing support in their own domestic populations for a continued commitment to Afghanistan.
Max, but we've certainly seen that happen in Great Britain, which has the second largest number of troops in Afghanistan. It's become controversial for the government there. Are you concerned that there may be less international support, not more, when it comes to Afghanistan?
Absolutely. That's a real concern. And that actually, I disagree a little bit with Nathan there, because he said that it was a mistake for us not to turn over Afghanistan to NATO sooner. In fact, I think what we've seen is that we have turned Afghanistan over to NATO in the last 2 years, and it's really been a disaster, because most NATO nations are not willing to make the kind of commitment necessary to really fight on the ground, because they came in thinking they would be doing some kind of nonviolent peacekeeping mission, and they weren't prepared for the sort of hard counterinsurgency door-to-door combat they actually had to undertake. Now, the British have been an exception. They've actually fought very hard and have suffered real losses. The Canadians have done very well. The Australians have done very well, a few others. But even in those countries, Canada and Britain and others, there is strong public pressure to pull out the troops. And, you know, I don't think that's going to happen anytime soon, but that's something we have to be cognizant of. And clearly the Taliban are wily enough to make that an element of their strategy, to try to inflict losses on our NATO allies to drive them out of Afghanistan, the kind of strategy they also pursued in Iraq when, for example, they drove the Spanish troops out of Iraq.
You know, the sampling of opinion we get with and call-in shows and with emails is not in any way scientific, but I have to tell you that the single largest theme, the single most consistent theme we're seeing in the emails we're getting today is on people who are very concerned about the war and want us to get out. Here's one from John. He says, I think I am a reasonably intelligent person, yet I do not understand what the U.S. role or intentions are in Afghanistan. If Obama thinks this is so important, he needs to explain to the American people why we are there. Here's another one from Inez, writing us from Delray Beach, Florida. The administration better get their act together and have a clear exit strategy. If they don't, then this situation will become their Vietnam. I wish I was in the White House advising the president. And Doug in Virginia writes us, you say the war can be won if there's a shift in strategy, like the wars in Iraq, on drugs, on health care debt, on investment fraud, on cancer. Max, but we're really hearing a lot of skepticism from Americans about why we're there and what the likely outcome is going to be.
Well, that's not surprising because I don't think that President Obama has done a very good job of explaining what we're up to. In fact, there's been really a mismatch between his actions, which bespeak a fairly substantial long-term American commitment, and his words, which talk in fairly minimalist terms about simply chasing al-Qaeda. And he never uses words like nation-building or, you know, long-term counterinsurgency. And so I don't think he's done a very good job of explaining in defending the war effort to the American public. That's something I think he really has to improve on if he's going to increase our troop commitment, which I think is important to do. But I think he also needs to do a better job of explaining and justifying what he's up to.
Nathan Fryer, do you agree?
Yeah, I mean, I very much agree with Max on that. I mean, there's definitely a mismatch between the rhetorical objective of what we're doing there and the means and ways we're going about doing it. But I would argue actually that the rhetorical objective needs to be the objective, that we need to prevent the resurgence of sanctuary in Afghanistan and refocus on the al-Qaeda problem in Pakistan and then resource that strategy properly.
I'd note that over the weekend, Senator Russ Feingold from Wisconsin, who's a liberal Democrat, called for a flexible timetable to withdraw U.S. forces from Afghanistan. Now, that may not be surprising. He was a big critic of the war in Iraq. But then this morning, we saw George Will, the conservative columnist, also call for the administration to rapidly reverse the trajectory of Americans' involvement in Afghanistan. I'm Susan Page, and you're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. Let's go back to the phones and take another caller. We'll go to Jonathan, who's been holding on for a long time from St. Louis. Jonathan, thanks for holding.
Thank you. In response to your earlier military man's comment about, and I quote, it's not that I think the American people don't want war in Afghanistan, it's that they want to see progress. And I'm here to say no, we really don't want war in Afghanistan. This reminds me of Kennedy in 1963, when the people clearly didn't want war, and when he finally decided to enact that and yank all the supply and the CIA ties and clean it up, he was taken out because the military didn't want that. They wanted to keep running their business. I think that's what the danger Obama has now is that he loves playing the politician, he loves being a good guy to everyone, but man, when you got the military breathing down your neck, but we need money, we need this business, we need these contracts. Man, that's kind of a rough place to be for Obama. So all I can say to all the cynics, all the people that are angry at him right now is he's got 8 years to clean up what Bush messed up. So if you're going to be angry, be mad at Bush for another couple of years until Obama's got eight in, and then you could be angry then.
All right, Jonathan, thanks for your call. Nathan Fryer.
Let me just actually step up and defend the senior officers for a second, because I think that's incredibly important under these circumstances. I think the senior military officers have been given a mission, and they're evaluating their mission based on the objectives they've been given by the president, the secretary of defense, et cetera. And they're coming up with their, you know, reasoned, honest appraisal of what's required to achieve those objectives over time in Afghanistan. And I don't think it's anything more than that.
You know, Max, but we've had several emailers and callers who mention the Russian experience in Afghanistan, but drawing some parallels. Do you see parallels there with what the U.S. is doing now?
Not really. I mean, there's huge, huge differences because the Russians were intensely unpopular from day one. They had their puppet government had almost no popular support. The popular legitimacy was on the side of the Mujahideen, who were fighting the Red Army, whereas in this case, all the public opinion polls show that it's the Taliban who have almost no public support. Only about 4% want them to return. So public legitimacy is really on the side of the democratically elected government in Kabul, which is the one that we are supporting. And there's another major difference, which is that the Russians were not really pursuing anything that we would recognize as counterinsurgency. They were pursuing a scorched earth policy of shooting up villages, killing civilians, committing terrible atrocities. So no wonder the people of Afghanistan were opposed to them. Now, I mean, we've certainly had some problems with errant bombs here and there, but, you know, we've been much more discriminating in our application of firepower, and General McChrystal has imposed even tighter rules on the dropping of bombs. So we are being very careful to win over the public and not to alienate them with needless applications of violence, which is something that the Red Army did in the 1980s. So, you know, I wouldn't draw too many parallels between their experience and our experience today.
Max Boot and Nathan Fryer, let me thank you for joining us this hour on the Diane Rehm Show.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
I'm Susan Page of USA Today, sitting in for Diane Rehm. Thanks for listening.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Jonathan Smith, Susan Neighbors, and Denise Couture. The engineer is Toby Schreiner. Dory Annisman answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives and CD sales, transcripts from SoftScribe and podcasts. Call 202-885-1200 for more information. Our email address is drshow@wamu.org. This program comes to you from American University in Washington. This is NPR, National Public Radio.